Hello and welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast 51 for May 25th, 2010. My name is David Liu, and with me today are
Dominic Rabia,
Ben Snakeoff,
and David O'Brien.
And as a twist to our usual podcasting, some of these gentlemen are actually with me today, or rather, I have made my way up to Boston, and we are recording three of us together live and one via Skype. So, exciting news for the one-year anniversary of Technically Legal coming up soon. We've got three great stories today. First, Google and their new video format codec. Second is the Pennsylvania Attorney General subpoenaing a Twitter user to find out who the actual user is. And then finally, a case from here in Massachusetts involving MySpace and its use in a court case. So to start off, Google at their I.O. conference announced a new video codec called WebM. And this was making some news because it's intended to be an open source and royalty-free video format. And it came to Google from acquiring a company called Onto. And it's been getting a lot of support from other players in the industry, notably Mozilla, Opera, Skype, who else? Flash, and obviously Google will be using it in Android, Chrome, and YouTube, but it is not currently, there are no current plans to be supporting it in from Microsoft, at least not initially in or by default in Internet Explorer 9, and Apple has also expressed some skepticism about the freeness of this codec. So I'll open it up for discussion. What do you guys think? Is this actually going to be royalty-free and trademark-free and et cetera?
Yeah, well, the big problem is that there's a difference between something that's royalty-free from the person who provides it and something that's free of patent infringement from companies who own patents on related technology. And MPEG-LA, the company who owns patents in the H.264 codec, have already said that they're going to start a patent pool, so all the people who own patents related to that compression format can easily license it to people who are using the WebM codec. Essentially, they're saying, we think that our patents cover WebM, despite the fact that Google says it's both open source and royalty free.
I guess I should also add that H.264, which is one of the more commonly adapted codecs and supported by all those companies as well as a lot of cameras, there have recently been a lot of concerns on how open and or free it is. Notably, a lot of people were concerned when it was recently discussed that the H.264, which is the common way for recording for a lot of camcorders, is only useful for or is only licensed for personal use. And so a lot of people who are actually making commercial videos for this were a little concerned by that.
Wasn't House actually recorded? An entire season of House was recorded using H.264, because that's what the high-end Canon...
It was just the last episode. The season finale was recorded entirely on a 5D Mark II. Right. And if that encodes in H.264, then yes, that is correct.
And I think that would qualify as a commercial use.
Yes, it would. David O'Brien, any thoughts on your end about this?
Well, have any of you guys had a chance to read any of the patents that people are claiming cover this technology?
I haven't. Have you?
No, not in particular, but I'm always curious about, you know, how much the patents actually cover the technology that they think it's covering versus what the patents actually say. And we all know the best way, if you're a patent prosecutor or a person who is actually writing the applications to obtain a patent, the best way to write those patents tends to be to try to get it as broad as possible. And you want to do that if you have an invention that, you know, a lot of other people are either trying to invent around or have similar technology that to the invention that you have. And when you write a patent broadly, then you have the at least the potential to clear out the marketplace down the road once you actually get the patent, the patent is granted to you, and then you can use your technology in lieu of and prevent others from using any other technologies that are pretty similar to it. There are a couple of doctrines in patent law which support this. The most notable that I can remember is called the Doctrine of Equivalence, and it's a limitation doctrine that attempts to prevent you from sort of inventing around certain types of patents. And so you don't literally have to read off of all of the claims in a patent, but if you read off of some of them or most of them or get pretty close to all of them, in some cases a court might say you're still liable for infringement in those circumstances. You guys have any thoughts on if you haven't read the patents, you probably don't have any thoughts on this, but I mean, if the patents are actually covering what they think it covers, are we really looking at stuff here that is covered by other patents? And then what's the effect of the patent pool?
Well, my impression from what I've heard about these patents is that they're broadly written to cover pretty much any modern-day video encoding technique, which may mean that it is, in fact, too broad. On the other hand, this may be a moot point when Bilski gets released, hopefully within the next couple of weeks. You know, if all this is a process patent that's using math to manipulate video, it very well may not be a patentable subject matter after Bilski. You know, that's just speculation on my part. As for the patent pool, though, I mean, it would make it easier for people to obtain licenses for these, but even right now, H.264 is offered without a license until, I think, 2017. So, as for, the patent pool, it won't get you much, except maybe it'll get MPEG-LA, extra damages for willful infringement, should they ever actually prosecute somebody who's using this codec.
What's interesting about this from Google's perspective is they aren't indemnifying anyone from any patent lawsuits, and further, they actually haven't said why they think this codec is patent-free. They just said it is, without backing it up in any way. And from people doing technical analysis on the format itself, they seem to think it's really similar to the H.264, and the technical people looking at it, although they haven't looked at the H.264 patents, say it just looks like H.264, and they'd be surprised if it doesn't infringe or at least write upon the 864 patents.
Yeah,
H.264. So maybe you guys, especially Dominic and David, can talk a little bit about the technical aspects of video compression, if you guys have any knowledge in that area. And, I mean, how different can inventions that do all sorts of video compression actually differ? Because they all seem to sort of do the same thing to me, but maybe there's some technical parts that make them really distinct from each other.
Well, a lot of what goes into video codecs is, I mean, the biggest part of it is compression. Getting it so that you don't have to record the color of each pixel at each time point in some knowledgeable way. And so what a lot of them do, and I believe H.264 and WebM do this, is come up with some prediction method. So if, for example, this certain pixel has been red for, the last 20 frames, it is likely to be red on the 21st frame, and unless there's coding in there to say otherwise. So it's that sort of idea applied on a much larger scale in order to get much higher levels of compression down. And so, as with any complicated algorithm with this much data to play with, there are a number of different ways to do that, and I would argue that there are probably many different unique ways to do that. However, how many unique ways WebM is doing it compared to H.264, I think that's open to interpretation. And without having read a lot of the source code and papers on these codecs, I don't think I can say whether or not they're the same.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Ogg Theora went through some of the same things. Ogg Theora is the video side of the video, I guess, analog to Ogg Vorbis, which is an audio codec. And it's actually part of the WebM standard. The WebM standard is VP8, which is some sort of open source video compression technology combined with Ogg Vorbis audio. Is it really compression? It's lossless compression, isn't it?
I mean, it's compression in the sense that you don't write down every bit.
Okay.
But if you still have a good way to do that, that you don't lose information, then, yeah, it's...
lossless. Okay. So people were trying to push this as opposed to H.264, and one person emailed Steve Jobs about this, and Steve Jobs said, well, for one, it's not as good as H.264, and two, just because it's offered... they claim it's patent-free doesn't mean it doesn't infringe on other patents. And he said that they were getting people together to start a suit against Ogg Theora, which apparently now seems pretty irrelevant, because I don't know of anyone who is using Ogg Theora who is still championing Ogg Theora now that WebM has been announced. Everyone's, in fact, backing away from it pretty quickly.
Interesting. So it sounds like there's still some questions as to what the ultimate validity might be, but we haven't seen the patents. We don't know what they actually look like or what they claim, and what the competing technology that Google here is championing actually looks like in comparison to those other technologies. But, you know, those could all end up being argued in court under like an obviousness theory or a novelty theory, that being that the new technology or the older technology, the ones that the non-Google format really use were obvious at the time, meaning that, you know, there's a finite number of ways to work around video compression, and on the basis of that, you know, anything that they tried to patent therefore might not, you know, actually be patentable because it's just too obvious to a person who has skill in the art.
If I had to make a prediction, I would predict this will turn out to infringe on patents existing. I mean, Microsoft tried something similar with the VC1 codec a couple years ago, and they're like, this is patent-free, and then a couple months later, a patent pool was formed for that, because enough people were like, no, actually, we have a patent that reads on this, and so I would expect this to end up much the same way, with not being as patent-free as Google initially thought it was, and people are probably going to be pretty reluctant to use it because Google isn't indemnifying people from lawsuits, which means that if you do get sued for patent infringement, you're going to be paying for it, not Google. Even though Google was like, use it, it'll be great. So,
although it does seem like it has a number of decent corporate partners already signed on to use it. I'm looking at one technical analysis, and it goes on much greater detail than even I can understand at this point, but the summary for the lazy, which we'll post in the show notes, says that, you know, there are some parts that are comparable to H.264, but then, you know, there are other parts, there are different components such as the spec, the encoder, the T-coder, which some parts are better, some parts are worse, and it also thinks that WebM is a stupid name. So, any final thoughts on this story before we move on?
One last quick thing that we could talk about is just the patent pools are pretty interesting. They've existed, I believe, since the 1800s, and those pop up when you have a number of people who hold patents in different technologies that sort of serve to block others that are trying to create competing products that use a number of different type of patented technologies or inventions, but can't do that because there's all these different patent holders out there. And so what you have, the result is a bunch of people who have little bits and pieces of inventions that really can't be put together without the authorization from the other patent holders. And so when that happens, sometimes you get these patent pools. And so all the patent holders get together, they sort of pool their rights together in what we call a patent pool. And then they sort of authorize, and sometimes they'll set up complex royalty schemes for how the person who wants to create the technology that involves all these different patents can then pay out to all the different patent holders and eventually create some sort of new technology that involves all those different pieces that are subject to different patents.
Yeah, and the reason that these happen is because it would ordinarily be too onerous for one person to go to each and every individual patent holder and try to negotiate one-on-one the rights that they need to, you know, make this technology that ends up encompassing a lot of patents. So the owners of those technologies get together and make the pool so that, you know, it'll be easier for people to license it, and it'll be easier for people to get money. It'd be easier for the patent owners to get money off of their patents.
So Google has not promised to any protection from lawsuits, but is there a particular method for doing that?
of protecting people from law. Well, Google could say, we're going to indemnify anyone who uses this. If you get sued, we'll pay your legal costs and we'll go to court for you.
Yeah, cover whatever damages. Those are pretty... I mean, I've never seen that in an
open
source.
That's really rare,
yeah.
Because that can be very expensive.
Right, so. Especially when you're doing something like this. I would be shocked if anyone has ever done that in an open source project where they're not getting any money flowing to them.
Usually you see it in agreements between two corporations where one corporation is licensing its patent-protected technology to another. And to help sort of sweeten the deal, they'll say, if it turns out that someone's going to sue you over using our patent, we'll cover your legal costs because it's our patent and you're using it, so don't worry about that.
Yeah, and the company in that case even has a vested interest in protecting their own intellectual property.
Right.
Okay, last thoughts?
I'm all set. Dominic's nodding. David Liu is nodding. So, Dominic, take it away with our next story.
So our next story pertains to Twitter. Apparently, the Pennsylvania Attorney General, Tom Corbett, has issued subpoenas to various Twitter users for a grand jury investigation because he wants to know who these anonymous commentators are. One of these Twitterers, I guess, Casablanca PA, has tweeted stuff such as, is it wrong to mix campaign work with taxpayer business? Apparently not when Tom Corbett does it. And the Attorney General is trying to basically figure out who these anonymous people are. And to do so, he's launched a grand jury investigation and subpoenaed Twitter. Twitter actually informed the users that they had been subpoenaed, and unless they filed a motion to quash, they would be giving that information to the Attorney General. So I want to start this off by asking Ben, why is the Attorney General picking a grand jury investigation of all things?
Well, the Attorney General is alleging that some unnamed crime has occurred, and as a result, he's investigating this crime. And he's gone to the grand jury and said, so the grand jury in this case will know what crime they're investigating. We'll probably know what crime they're investigating. And they'll, you know, present this information, and Tom Corbett one of his underlings will have gone to the grand jury and said, listen, we're investigating this crime. These are the relevant statements, and in order to prosecute this crime, we need to know who said them. So will you, the grand jury, issue a subpoena? And the grand jury, you know, votes on it and issues the subpoena.
So would it be a crime related to those statements, or...?
I mean, that's what he's going to have to allege, especially now that, you know, it's become public. If it's not related to these statements or not related to some other activity on the Twitter account, which, since his Twitter can really only be statements, the motion to quash is almost certainly going to be allowed.
So there's also the related blog, which is hosted by Google's Blogspot, under the same name, Casablanca PA, and the express purpose of which is exposing the hypocrisy of Tom Corbett. So there's also plenty of material there.
Yeah, I'm kind of interested. There hasn't been any leak, at least, or even speculation, to the best that I could see, as to what crimes he's alleging have been committed, which is going to be very important if he actually expects to not have these subpoenas quashed. Because if it's just people talking, you know, non-defamatory things, you know, things that have great public interest about whether or not he's abusing his power in that office, there's no way he's going to win the motion. You know, he's not going to get these names.
Yeah, I mean, there's a pretty strong First Amendment right to criticize public officials. And it doesn't appear like the Twitter account is doing anything in the line of death threats or anything that would be...
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I could think of is some sort of absurd campaign law.
Well, what about like, the, I don't know, the unauthorized release of government information or something along those lines? I'm sort of creating something here that might become a crime somehow under the Pennsylvania law, but if he had reason to believe that these individuals were discussing matters that were related to, say, sensitive documents that were all part of the government, and let's say that the Attorney General, Corbett, had some reason to believe that those documents were obtained in an illicit or illegal manner, I suppose that might become the basis of a grand jury investigation. But what I'm confused about here, and I think a lot of the articles that are reporting on this, is whether he's upset about the comments because they seem to be defamatory in nature, or whether there is, or he actually believed there to be some sort of criminal aspect going on behind the scenes related to these comments. And if we're talking defamation, and I'm not familiar with Pennsylvania law, but defamation tends to be a civil suit, not a criminal suit. So I'm not. Yeah. I'm still not sure on the, for those reasons why a grand jury would be investigating the comments themselves.
So to toss in some breaking news that we just found out, apparently the Attorney General actually dropped the Twitter subpoena. He had put someone named Brett Kott behind bars, or was in the process of putting him behind bars in a political corruption investigation. And the reason he had subpoenaed these users were to find out whether or not they were this Mr. Brett Kott, to demonstrate to the jury that that he was showing a lack of remorse and no contrition, that sort of aspect. But he's dropped the Twitter subpoena since then, so it looks like they're not even going to have to try to quash it because he's just withdrawn the request.
Yeah, going to your point, though, briefly, David, the subpoena did specifically say that, you know, they were investigating some criminal matter, and, yeah, unless there's some sort of criminal defamation statute, which probably, I don't know if it probably wouldn't be constitutional, depending on how it was written, it may not be constitutional. And so it was either, you know, criminal defamation, if that actually exists in Pennsylvania, or some other crime. In this case, it looks like it was related to the political corruption investigation.
Which, I mean, if it were related to the political corruption investigation, like they were just trying to use the grand jury to find out, are these the guy? Is this the guy? That's still not the right way to use a grand jury investigation subpoena. I mean,
right.
Well, it might not be, but if you, I mean, and I'm not saying that this was the case here, and I don't believe that it was, but if you have comments that are going on anonymously that are being used to incite violence or incite a riot, and under First Amendment law, if those actions make it appear that, you know, that those violent actions or the riots are imminent after the comments, then I think, you know, assuming that there are the correct provisions under Pennsylvania law, then you might have a way then to be also investigating the statements for criminal stuff, and in that case, I think it would probably be okay for grand jury investigation, but it's kind of a stretch. It's hard to imagine how imminent something could be if we're talking about online comments versus comments in person, like the person standing on a soapbox in the corner in front of a large crowd who's saying, you know, okay, everybody, let's grab the pitchforks and the oil and let's go run down to the Attorney General's office right now and let's burn it down, and everybody looks like they're about to do it. That's totally different than, say, like a blog post or a tweet that, even though those are going on in real time, you know, it's hard to imagine that that would actually create some sort of imminent lawless action.
Well, to speculate idly, there's this idea called flash mobs that's sort of been cycling around in the last couple of years, where people will be like, all right, 1 p.m., we all meet here, and everyone wear a red hat or something. And I guess perhaps that could, I mean, depending on what they wanted to do, and or everyone bring a tomato, we'll throw it at the Attorney General. He'll be giving a political fundraising speech here and here at this time. We'll all show up 5 minutes into the speech with the tomato. But even then, that, even though, I mean, some of those people might be arrested for, I guess, disturbing the peace, or I'm not entirely sure what they would be arrested for, but it'd be hard to lock down who the actual commentator was beforehand, and even afterwards, you might as well just prosecute the people there.
Right.
I have to wonder whether there's some issues of the Streisand effect that would play into this, because I'm sure there are plenty more people checking out the these two blogs and Twitter accounts that probably wouldn't have been checking them before and finding out more about the alleged crimes or misdeeds of the Attorney General, and whether that could possibly hurt him in his campaign for governor. But also, the one curious comment that I thought came out of this was the guy behind the Casablanca PA Twitter account said that we have a constitutionally protected right to speak anonymously.
That is true to some degree, in that various courts have found that the First Amendment does include a right to anonymous speech, although the full scope of that hasn't really been played out yet.
It's not an absolute right either. I mean, there are circumstances where you know, your right to speak anonymously or your right to just speak in general, whether you're anonymous or not, you know, doesn't actually protect you. So those are just the classic limitations of the First Amendment also.
Yeah, so your right to anonymous speech goes out the window as soon as you do anything illegal. As soon as you download a file illegally, as soon as you threaten someone, or as soon as you even commit defamation, the court's going to say, you know what, your right to anonymous speech is gone now that you've defamed someone.
You can't yell fire in a theater anonymously.
With intent to cause a panic. You cannot falsely yell fire in a theater, crowded theater, with intent to cause a panic. I'm out of things to say about this story because of the late-breaking news, which by the time this gets released on Tuesday will no longer be late-breaking news. But
when was that released? Tell me that wasn't released today.
No, it was released Friday late afternoon. So
yeah,
I did miss that.
Yep. Okay, I guess we'll move on a little early to our last story. We posted about this on the blog with a little explanation about it. In Massachusetts, there was a first-degree murder, and the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, which is the highest court in the land, highest court in the Commonwealth, took a review of this case, and they were looking at reasons why the verdict may have to be thrown out. And in this case... So the defendant's brother sent several messages to a potential witness in this case, urging the witness not to testify. On a side note, that brother is probably now or already has been prosecuted for witness intimidation, which in Massachusetts includes just asking them very nicely not to testify. As a side note, another thing that includes witness intimidation, as a quick side note, if I call up, let's say David Liu is a potential witness in a case, and I'm the defense attorney and I don't want him to testify, if I call up and say, hey, David Liu, this is so-and-so calling from the district attorney's office, turns out we don't need you to come in on Monday and testify, so, you know, thanks for your help, that's also witness intimidation.
I am intimidated.
Yeah.
So. Or if he's scheduled to testify Tuesday and the trial ends Wednesday, yeah, we actually need you to just... testify on Thursday?
Yeah. So. Also witness intimidation. So the brother sent these MySpace messages. And during the trial, the witness took the stand, and the the prosecution tried to introduce these MySpace messages against the defendant. There are a bunch of problems that come out of this. The first of which is that they're not really admissible. They don't prove much of anything against the defendant. They prove something against the defendant's brother. Secondly, they're hearsay. So they're not admissible there. The Supreme Judicial Court, in their analysis, kind of glossed over these because the authentication problem also existed, and that's what I think we're really here to talk about now. So authentication is it's basically proving that the evidence that you're introducing is what it is, that it comes from the person you say it's come that you say it comes from, that it's accurate. The authentication of testimony is usually proven by that is what the evidence is what it purports to be, and or that there are circumstances that exist that imply that the thing is what its proponent represents it to be. And in this case, the Supreme Judicial Court took a look at the evidence that was supporting, you know, that these MySpace messages were in fact from the defendant's brother, and said there wasn't really enough to show that. Anybody want to chime in? What do you think? So in this case, all they had was that the defendant's picture was on his MySpace account, and that the witness said that his MySpace screen name was Do It For It. And that was all that supported it. The Supreme Judicial Court, were you going to say something?
Wasn't there also a history of communication between the defendant and the witness?
Was there?
I thought that they had communicated before on this account, so...
Okay.
The intimidating messages came from the same account that he had communicated from before, and he knew that, or he assumed it was... that guy before.
Yeah, but that raises the next problem, which is, okay, even if he used it before, there wasn't any evidence as to how secure MySpace is, what it takes to get into somebody's account. There wasn't any information after that. you know,
I mean, it could have been someone else.
Yes. So. And it wasn't that, you know, this isn't a case where there's no way you could ever prove that these MySpace messages were from someone, because it could always be someone else. The court basically says you need some information on how secure MySpace is, you know, what the procedures are to log into somebody's account, what it would take to, you know, to use somebody else's account. And from there, once you have that information, the jury can be left up to deciding whether or not it was actually from that person or not. As long as there's, you know, enough evidence to support a reasonable inference that it was the defendant's brother in this case, that'd be fine. It raises interesting questions for other forms of electronic communication too, like a text message. All that I have to do to get somebody else to send a text message from my phone is to, you know, leave it in a bar, a brew house in San Francisco.
Actually, that was Redwood City, I think, or Menlo Park, maybe. It was in the Bay Area, nonetheless.
Yeah, and I beer garden.
Welcome to the German edition of Technically Legal.
Yeah.
So getting back to the story here, though, there was also a picture, I think, of this of the brother, right? That was
His picture was on his MySpace account, but I could put your picture on my fake MySpace account because I don't have one, or my likely soon to be deleted Facebook account. That doesn't really prove much. What?
My Facebook account is gone.
Yeah.
So what was the real problem here? Was just that they didn't introduce supporting evidence to authenticate this that explained the MySpace security measures and
basically,
other
my
nexus.
Understanding is that they sort of assume that just because the message is sent from his account, it's his, and they didn't go to any lengths to prove this or even show how that might be the case to the jury. They didn't say, well, it's likely that it's going to be his because he has a password that he has to enter. The IP address, the only one used is the one that matches with his home. They didn't do any of this at all. They just said, well, I mean, it's his account, so it's obviously his message, and didn't back it up in any way.
I mean, was there also an issue because it was more or less printed out from the potential witness's computer and just introduced as evidence due by printing it out? I mean, I won't say I've done that in any legal case, but I've definitely faked screenshots before of various social things and, you know, used that as at least a prank. So it's not that hard.
Yeah, it actually wasn't even printed out from the witness's computer. I believe it was printed out on a computer in the courthouse the day that the person testified, which led to another thing of the people saying, the defense was saying it was, you know, unfairly sprung upon us the day of the testimony.
Interesting.
Again, the court didn't really get to that, to answering that question, because they just said it was improperly authenticated, so it shouldn't have come in.
So why wasn't this contested during the trial itself, or was it?
It was unobjected to at trial, and I haven't the slightest idea as to why.
See, what bothers me about this, though, is it seems like if there had been some sort of objection during trial, then maybe the prosecution would have had that moment to go back and, you know, find the supporting evidence they might have needed to, you know, talk about the security measures, to talk about the connection between this account and this person. And I mean, we all know that once you submit information across web services like social networking sites on the internet, the information just doesn't die when you delete it. It's usually there. It's there in the form of logs. You're logging IP addresses. There's all sorts of things on the technical back end that are used to verify messages when they are sent and the times that they are sent and who they are sent to. And you could have corroborated that with additional supporting evidence that this guy was at the home during that time, and you know, it just seems like you could have created or found enough supporting evidence to create that inference that it was probably this guy who sent the message. And
if it makes you feel any better, the person's still in jail for life without parole. It's not like he got out because of this, or, you know, anything's going to change. The Supreme Judicial Court looked at the, you know, they said, you know, this was an error, and then they looked at it and they said, okay, but it didn't create a, what our test is a substantial risk of a miscarriage of justice. You know, there's plenty of other, evidence that was supporting this conviction, and in the end, this wasn't, you know, all this went to is whether or not his brother thought he was guilty, not whether he himself was guilty, the defendant. So, I mean, yes, it would have been nice if there were an objection, and it would have been nice if the prosecution, well, first, if there was an objection, that the judge actually sustained the objection, which I think is a stretch. I don't think there are many superior court judges who would have said, oh no, there's no way this evidence is authenticated after, you know, you've got the witness's testimony that says, I've talked with him before on this account, his picture's on the account, and I know this to be his screen name. You know, it sounds like that's enough evidence from which a reasonable jury could infer that the defendant's brother did it.
I guess why I bring all this up is just to keep it all in context when we're talking about authentication of electronic messages in other types of trials or civil proceedings. It just seems to me that it's totally possible this day and age that there is enough evidence that one might be able to find to support something like an authentication issue for electronic messages. And although it did not work out well procedurally in this case, I'm of the opinion that it could easily be worked out in other cases as long as the lawyers are diligent in researching these things.
Okay, I guess we're going to wrap up now unless anybody has any last thoughts. We'll go around my table first. David Liu?
There was the issue we discussed way back in episode 25 of the gentleman who used his Facebook status as an alibi in the case of a robbery.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I mean, I don't remember if they went through the same legal channels to prove whether or not that was authentically him. I think it did come from the right IP address, but I don't recall.
I don't remember if it even got that far. I think once he proved to the district attorney that he was not in that he was, you know, on the other side of New York City, the district attorney agreed to dismiss the charges. Yeah. It didn't get to a jury
We didn't get the same authentication issue. Right,
yeah. But. It's also, that was in New York and not Massachusetts. I don't know if New York's dealt with this issue before or if they've got different standards. Last thoughts, Dominic?
So what is the standard for authenticating electronic messages from MySpace or otherwise in Massachusetts in the wake of this case?
You have to introduce something that will, from which the jury could infer that the person who is alleged to have sent the message actually sent the message, and that could be, you know, testimony about how difficult it is to access somebody else's account, general security information about the website, or any other information you would have about, you know, I guess, you know, what knowledge the person has of the topics that are included. I mean, I don't think there's any hard and fast rule that this case announced. It was just that, you know, what they put into evidence was not enough.
Sounds good.
One guess is that people using MySpace aren't signing their messages with public keys and things of that nature.
Yeah. David O'Brien, any last thoughts?
No, I think we've covered it pretty well. I mean, you did point out, just this goes to Dominic's question, what the authenticity standard is, and reading right out of the case here, authenticity is usually proved by testimony of a witness, either one, that the thing is what its proponent represents it to be, or two, that circumstances exist which imply that the thing is what its proponent represents it to be. So that's your basic authentication standard, and building off of that for electronic messages, you know, it's probably all the things we were just talking about, where you can find various pieces of evidence in how the message is actually sent over the service, and whatever IP address logs you can get out of that, or time logs, and stuff like that. Another corroborating evidence would include whether or not the person was sitting at the computer at the time, or whether at least you could establish that he was in the house at the time, and maybe he was the only person in the house at the time. I mean, a whole range of possibilities of evidence that you might be able to find.
Okay. I would like to thank everyone for listening to the Technically Legal Podcast. This was episode 51 again. I'm going around our table first. I was Ben Snitkoff.
David Liu.
Dominic Rabia.
And I am David O'Brien.
Yeah, I guess I still am Ben Snitkoff, now that you mention it. anyway, we'd again like to thank you for listening. Please head over to our website, www.technicallylegal.org. Hit us up on Twitter, @TechLegal, or send your comments, questions, requests to us, podcast@technicallylegal.org. Thank you, and have a good day.
Or follow us at Casablanca PA.
That's a lie.
No speakers.